Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. Should we study history to search for lessons it might teach or to discern its relevance to our own preoccupations? What were earlier generations of historians trying to convey in their institutions or through wider instruction? Beyond a chronicle of past events, does history have meaning? In this edition of Black's History Week, The Critic's political editor Graham Stewart talks to Professor Jeremy Black, author of Contesting History and Clio's Battles, about whether the past can be a servant to the present.
Well, Professor Black, it's the end of one year and the beginning of another. It's a time to be asking some big questions. And the question I want to start with for you today is, does history have meaning?
Oh, well, that's very, very interesting. I think, and we ought to make it clear to the audience, we haven't pre-discussed this, so I don't know which way this is going and you don't know which way this is going. But let's say there are two different things one could talk about. We could talk about the question as to whether the process of change in the past has meaning, and we could talk about the question of whether our interpretations of the past have meaning. Now, I think the latter is definitely the case. That meaning doesn't necessarily tell you much about the past, it tells you a lot about the present. And that's true whether we're talking about family narratives of the past of an individual family, of ancestors, or whether you're talking about states and their public history, or whether you're talking about academic debate or diatribe. All of those have meaning, generally much more than the people who are voicing them realize, in the sense that most people who will tell you about the past, whether they will tell you about their family, the nation, academic matters, would like to present themselves as being sort of in some way clear-minded and clear-sighted. But in practical terms, we can generally see that there are either implicit or explicit narratives. And I've tried to have a go at discussing that in my book Clio's Battles, Historiography and Practice, and my book Contesting History. Now, the other question, which is I think a much harder one, and one where in a sense we might look at how this has changed across time, is the question of whether the actual process of history has meaning, and if so, what do we mean by meaning? And here we've got a number of issues. First of all, the vast bulk of the past, and here we're just restricting ourselves to this planet, is one in which there is no human record. Human beings weren't there. So even if one is then going to look at a very tiny fragment of time, which is the presence of human beings, for most of that period of time, we have no real way of interrogating sources in a fashion that is going to enable us to say very much about, well, the views held by contemporaries. And obviously, for a large portion of that time, one's looking at archaeology rather than history. There is an overlap between the two, and they're not necessarily separate. But nevertheless, if you think, and we'll underline the if, of history as largely being related to periods of time for which there are written records, then we've got an even smaller fragment of time. Now, of that fragment of time, I would suggest that most of those who've tried to present meaning have done so in terms of what we would call religions. And that might be regarded as a functionalist account of religion, and I'm not simply trying to say that religion only has a functional value. It obviously has much more than that, but from the point of this discussion, that functional approach, an attempt to provide identity, meaning, to provide a linkage between past, present and future, is one that remains to the present day. And, you know, I would hazard, I don't wish to get involved in a discussion as to how many people today are devout, but a large number are. And for them, the meaning of time is in part a matter of narratives of salvation and redemption. I'm not really qualified to talk about those, but I do think that the way in which most academic work on history does not devote itself to considering that helps to explain, there are many other reasons, but helps to explain its flawed character.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I wonder if I can just take a number of steps back and ask about your interpretation of you know, the sagas of antiquity. These are, in the first instance, not written down. They are oral stories of past deeds, which pass through various different interpretations and are expanded in the telling. I'd be very keen to get your sense of what real meaning they have for a society and also for historians. And I'd then like to go on and ask you about some early historians, and at the risk of being parochial, we'll take the British example of the Venerable Bede. When he was writing an interesting history of the English church and people, so the religious aspect, very important. What do we think of his intent? For whom was he writing? For what posterity? For his God? For a wider reading public who would pass by the monastery? What was in his mind?
Well, that packs up quite a lot, and we ought to do this over many, many, many sessions. Let's start off with, you were asking about early accounts. I think that many of those do demonstrate the interpenetration of the divine and the human. Whether you've got, as you of course have in a number of Asian societies, but also, for example, if you're thinking about the account of Troy, the War of Troy, you have gods who interfere in the works of man, and with great effect. And then, of course, you've got all of this issue. I have discussed it in a number of places about oracles and the extent to which there is free will or not involved in human beings' ability to seek to defy oracles or to misinterpret or interpret them. Now, you know, there's also a massive specialist literature on this, but what we're talking about here is the flawed attempt in many respects to create a world or a narrative of secular history which is outside a sacral context, and whether that sacral context is provided by appropriating deities, whether it's provided, but there's a whole host of ways it can be emblematic in stories. Whether the extent to which is explicit or not varies, but that's where this work sits. And I'm very dubious. In fact, one of the things I would argue is that, and here is that, a lot of modern historical writing is an attempt to derive meaning in a less religious age. But of course, ironically, what it does is create or pay obeisance to movements, interpretations, approaches to time, which themselves have a quasi-sacral character, whether you're talking about communism or the Nazi ideology or Mussolini's fascism, all of which are of course different in many respects, but they all have a common attempt to provide meaning in that respect. Now, let's go back to Bede. If you're looking at the ecclesiastical history of the English people, which I think I'm right is comes out in 731, it's an origin story, as indeed a lot of historical writing is, and the origin story is how Christianity came to England. Much of it, incidentally, deals with very recent history, even if the context of it or the background might be earlier. And the very recent history is the confrontation of the Celtic and English churches within a century of Bede's time. So you're thinking about things like the Synod of Whitby. And I think that is, again, typical of much writing in the past and on the past. It's intended to provide an account which makes sense of a particular interpretation of the recent past. Incidentally, he also wrote a book called On Time, and that was intended to challenge millenarian predictions, and that, of course, is a major concern for a long time of the Christian Church, which was to not accept Christians who offered alternative accounts, many of which put the church in a distinctly marginal position. And you can see, incidentally, if you're looking at Jewish theology and Jewish history, again, the same sort of tension between millenarian movements, which, for example, lead to things like the Hasidim, and other interpretations of time. Now, Bede's account is one which, in part, is a matter of a validation which exists irrespective of whom might look or read it or look at it. And remember, we're talking about an age in which the vast majority of people are illiterate. But it also, and I think this is important, is an institutional history. It comes out of a particular context in the Northumbrian church and its monastic characteristics, which is where the monasteries of the church, places like Lindisfarne, were great centres of intellectual activity, but they were also asserting their role. You can see the same thing, for example, ironically, in the Irish church, places like Clonmacnoise, the great monastery in Central Ireland there. And this, I think, again, is part of the special magic that, in a sense, telling a tale, providing a history which recounts the work of God, also provides a way of fixing special magic on a particular institution. And I think that is very significant for a lot of historical working, and you can see it all sorts of respects, I mean, and all sorts of issues. We can discuss, for example, the role of the papacy and the donation of Constantine, alleged and real forgeries which validate the particular claims of all sorts of institutions and families. So I think history has a purpose and meaning, which is that in one that you cannot take outside a sacral context.
Well, I'm interested you say that, because my question from that would be, were these in essentially teaching tools within the monastery, which didn't really go beyond that, or were they core materials with the expectation that, with the church's wider remit in society, they would percolate amongst the great unwashed as well and create meaning for them there?
Well, I wouldn't go, I mean, forget about the great unwashed for a second. I mean, obviously you have scriptoria where you will copy these works, and these works will be distributed to sister and in particular daughter houses of monasteries. So to that extent, they are disseminated. But I would argue that there are specialists you can address on this, that the monastic characteristic is different from that of one of a preaching clergy, let alone getting on subsequently to the friars, who, as you put it, go to the great unwashed. I don't think the friars are necessarily terribly washed, but that's another matter. And actually, if you pay any attention to modern science and the things that live on the skins of people who consider themselves well-washed, I think people might be very concerned about what one means by washing. But anyway, let's just shows how widely we range, doesn't it? I think also, if you go on and look at a lot of monastic works, they include portrayals of monarchs. So you can see that in work about Charlemagne, for example, or you can see that in a work like The Genealogy of the Kings of England, which Eldred of Rivo produced in the mid-1150s. And these are providing accounts of kings that portray, or in the case of Charlemagne, an emperor, a semi-sacral figure whose ability and willingness to heed divine injunctions matched the classical importance of heeding omens. So in many respects, what you have got is a Christianization, which is not to be surprised, no surprise here, a Christianization in the church context of classical accounts. But then, of course, family histories include saga-type elements, which you might see have a slightly different background. And they go on being produced, and obviously very famous ones in the medieval period, including the sagas coming out of Iceland. What can be communicated in an age prior to printing, prior to then things which are much more important than printing in a way, mass literacy, the production techniques which reduce the real cost of publications, the development of serial publications, including obviously things like newspapers. All of those provide you with an opportunity to disseminate accounts of the past and expositions of meaning, but in turn produce a pressure for meaning. I mean, I remember, and here we're going back to the mid-70s, as an undergraduate at Cambridge, I remember Dermot Fenlon lecturing on early modern Europe. Now, this is interesting what one's mind throws up. I hadn't thought about this for a long while. He eventually threw up his college fellowship, his university post in Cambridge, and discovered meaning by becoming a Catholic priest, which I think probably was, in a sense, more meaningful than taking part in the antics of the Cambridge history faculty. But I remember him saying that in the early modern period, and he was talking here about the Reformation, for many members of the peasantry, the health of their cattle, or the cattle with which they lived, if they were lucky, was a matter of meaning as well. And that one has to be very cautious, therefore, he threw it out as a throwaway line, but, you know, one has to be very cautious about assuming what is and isn't significant. But one thing I would like to suggest is that as you get socioeconomic developments and cultural developments in terms of more urbanization, more of an ability to afford a modicum of education of a formalized type, and greater literacy. So in turn, that creates a requirement for meaning in history that might be different to that which the bulk of the population had earlier.
So as we move from the church, from monasteries to universities, and maybe that move is not so great, given that in late medieval Europe, the universities are primarily religious foundations. So I want to pick up on that point and ask you to give a sense of how to what extent there was a continuum In the way in which history was conveyed and the meaning attributed to it, or whether the, as it were, the universitification, a horrible word which doesn't exist, of the process really changed it as a discipline.
Oh, well, that's, again, very interesting. I don't think one should necessarily see university teaching of a modern type, university scholarship, as necessarily per se different to that you might refer to as church. I mean, there's a number of things to think about. First of all, many of the academic figures, in particular of the 19th century, but also a significant number of important ones in the 20th century, were personally devout and personally believed that there was a significance to religion and religious purpose. So the fact that universities may develop in a way in which they cease to formally be religious institutions doesn't necessarily mean that they lack for many of their individuals religious purpose. And that religious purpose can include reconciling new knowledge or newly discovered knowledge, or knowledge which God has allowed you to discover newly, with established knowledge. And that, of course, is something that you can see very much in the 17th and 18th century. And, you know, most of the sort of work on the Enlightenment in recent years, not least in England, has emphasized its religious foundation and place in Christian thought. So there's that element. There's a separate element. If modern history, understood as what developed in the 19th century, and we can, you know, personally, I think a lot of what is modern as in contemporary is really very low standard. I think you'd actually get better history books in terms of quality of scholarship, understanding of the nature of source assessment 100 years ago than you would get now. But that's a very broad comment. I mean, obviously, we can qualify that endlessly. But if you're going to think of modern history as developing in the sense of source criticism, and as you know, I've written several works on the development of history, including on English history in the 18th century, but also my more broader ones on historiography. And here you're thinking of what the Germans call source criticism, associated in particular with Leopold von Ranke, etc., etc., etc. Now, source criticism is not new. I mean, as you may be aware, there is a lot of discussion which we might call of the Renaissance period, which involves textual consideration of classical texts, which you would consider not too different in that respect. And then you can go back and look in medieval discussion of the validity or otherwise of particular accounts, which themselves could be regarded as source criticism. So that pattern of 19th century source criticism is not new, but it becomes more prominent in the Western tradition, not least because of the influence of the German model, particularly through medieval scholarship, but also in North America. But obviously there are other patterns and developments in France and in England and so on. Now, if what you think of as modern history is simply what turns out from modern universities, then there is no inherent way in which you're going to take, shall we say, a modern idea, modern set of concept, I don't know, critical race theory, for example, which is, I would say, very low grade. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that you would argue that is anything other than a belief assertion, and that such systems of belief assertion masquerading as knowledge can be seen endlessly across time and will go on being seen endlessly across time.
Well, I want to ask about the interpretation of history as something that is there to teach us lessons. And my first question really reflects a prevailing culture in certainly many European universities in the early 19th century, where student debating societies were permitted only on the condition they didn't discuss contemporary politics. So that meant they started discussing historical themes which they thought were analogous to contemporary politics. Can we just pick up on that, that sense of actually using history to fight contemporary battles, and whether that has actually debased the real meaning of history as a consequence?
Well, I mean, you know, referring back to, as I said, I don't want to endlessly urge people to read my books because there are other works to read, but I do think I tried to answer that both in Contesting History and in Clio's Battles. First of all, I was dubious about the proposition that there was a perfect form of history, a kind of history or a Platonic concept, which has then been, as it were, shadowed by the wider public. I'm very dubious about that. I think that one has to be aware that much that is decried in the wider public sphere's discussion of the past, you can find within what is known as the academy. So, including faddishness, inadequate use of inadequate understanding of sources, crude theory, etc., etc., etc. So, after all, clever people can usually dress up their prejudices more readily than others. It doesn't mean they're any less prejudiced. So if what you are thinking about is the sense that teaching lessons from the past is a purpose of history, I would argue that an attempt to understand experience, however experience was presented, and it was presented in differing ways, is a common characteristic of a lot of subjects, that they are cumulative, that the nature of the species, or one of the natures of the species, is its ability to draw conclusions from data and to then pass those on, both in terms of very concrete processes of learning, but also in terms of what we might call theory, which can take a number of differing forms, some of which we applaud and some of which we don't applaud. So I would say that as it were, history is only an aspect of that, and I have gone on record elsewhere as saying that historians do not own the past, that they have differing ways themselves of interpreting past, present, and therefore future, but that there are others, other subjects, others from differing backgrounds who also seek to do so. What I would say it tends to characterize quality in any subject and in any sphere is a willingness to accept the contingent nature of interpretation, so that whether you're talking about physics or history, you are going to find yourself in a situation in which you need to accept that the answers 50 years hence, or even 5 years hence, or even today next door, are going to be different, and that ought to affect the way in which you discuss the subject. Now, many people lack that sense and framework and reference, and as I said, one of the difficulties today is that we are, certainly in Western culture, but going through a period of assertiveness, assertion, people validating themselves by the clarity in which they express themselves, and also by, this is separate but related, by basing it on what they feel as opposed to rational processes of thought, analysis, and criticism. Now, to my mind, validating yourself through how you feel is not a matter of sophistication, and by sophistication I mean showing an ability to understand the situation you are in and to learn from it, because essentially validating something on how you feel is a narcissistic approach, And that narcissism is the same whether it's collective or individual. And it's antithetical to anything which is rational. I mean, narcissism may be very easy to communicate to others, but it is not a process in which people can learn or can teach. And learning and teaching is necessary for a species if we wish to confront problems and issues, and for subsets of that species. So I would argue that the present culture, and here I'm talking very much about what I know, and I'm very happy for people to say, oh, well, there's Black, he's just being stupid. But the present culture that I see, both within universities and outside them, and I don't see any real distinction here, is one in which what's called virtue signaling, which is another form of narcissism around arguing that what makes people feel better is therefore per se intellectually more credible, that has unfortunately prevailed. And I think that if you were to look at the codes of conduct, the websites of history departments as to how they now express what they're trying to do, there is a lot of that and not enough skepticism about the values that they are enunciating.
And this is a relatively new development, or are we putting too much emphasis on the promotional spiel that departments come out with, but perhaps doesn't permeate more deeply into the study and transmission of historic thought?
Well, the last point, just to say, institutionally, it's very interesting, because if you get people into a corner on their own, many of them will tell you that what is coming out of their own universities, management structures, and those people running the situation is total crap, and they'll use that kind of language. But the problem is that actually it does affect the way in which people feel they can discuss matters. It does mean that there is a hollowing out of the process of humane skepticism, which ought to be part of an intellectual life and a social life. You know, you shouldn't just socialize with those who share your values, and you should be able to hold a position of living with others who are very different without feeling that they in some way are offending you. And need strictures. So all of that, obviously, there is a social and political and cultural element. But you ask, has there always been problems? Of course, as I mentioned earlier, there were, as it were, pseudo-religions like communism and fascism and Nazism, which were ideological and heavily accented on a feeling and an assertiveness as opposed to a position of critical thought. And they also rested on the notion of, in the case of the Nazis and the fascists, a kind of community notion. And what is interesting now is that whereas the traditional pattern of British thought was very much one of irony about such assertion. Now, unfortunately, we're seeing the same sort of patterns of stark affirmation becoming more significant in British life.
And is that confined to the academy? I mean, I wonder if there is a widening division between the public and private study of history, between the university and between historians and private practice, more popular historians?
Well, again, that's a really interesting question. And again, I suspect we need several sessions, and maybe we should give our next session to that. I'll start off by saying that always it has been the case that a lot of the top quality work in British history has come from people who weren't formerly academics. I mean, the greatest historian to write in the English language, in my view, is Edward Gibbon, and his comments on Oxford are well known. And he, of course, was an MP as well, for briefly. Well, no, not too briefly. He was an MP for a while. And again, I think if you could look at the 19th century and the 20th century, you will find other significant figures who weren't in the university context. I think that's now more the case, partly because although there are more academic historians than ever before, many of them are very much people devoted to, well, we'll leave aside the mediocrities that go off to become managers and equality and diversity officers and all the rest of it. Let's just look at those who are, in theory, taking part in research and teaching. Many of them have become very narrow. I mean, one of the great problems in British teaching is that people are allowed to focus very much on narrow areas of teaching and scholarship, which means they often lack the contextualization. I mean, I notice this very much whenever I'm asked to discuss empire, on which I've written a number of books. In fact, earlier this year I was asked, and Professor Gopal from Cambridge was the other person, and you know, she was making a number of rather foolish remarks about the British Empire and about imperialism, and you know, I made some mention about the need to talk about other imperial powers like Portugal, and she clearly knew absolutely nothing about it. So there's the very narrow aspect of the way in which a lot of academics now specialise. And I think often that you will get a broader account either from people in the writing outside the university, some of which are good, some of whom are terrible, exactly as university academics, or in fact some of the best work is often, a lot of this comes out of America, are world historians. Very interestingly, you know, for example, Patrick Manning and his school, or the people at the University of Hawaii. And those are, I think, writing some really very interesting works. Or if you look at people who have been in Britain, I mean, he's moved to America, but I would argue that the most gifted historian of my generation, Felipe Fernandez Armisto, you know, very broad ranging. And in fact, it's quite interesting. I mean, if you think of, you know, people like some of their works and they don't like some of their works, but if you're thinking about people who've often had the ability to bridge between the public and the private, the private being the institutional academic little mindset, and the public being, as it were, a willingness to reach out and to talk to a wider public audience. You can see of British historians, many of those who sought to do so were people who left the country, people like Niall Ferguson going to the United States, or Norman Stone going to Turkey, because they felt freer there, which I think is an interesting comment on the rigidity of the academy in Britain.
And is there a different, if not rigidity, then a different discipline, though, imposed upon the historian in private practice, which is the discipline of the market, which is to write popular texts, which have value. I'm very keen to write a popular text myself, but nevertheless, may not add a huge amount to historical scholarship.
Well, several things to think about. First of all, financial exigencies exist throughout. So within the university sector, people, you know, if you ask me, I wouldn't, you know, necessarily wish to name names, but if you ask me why it is that so many people who are very, very weak intellectually and are widely understood as weak intellectually have been given the title professor in many British universities, the answer is because they've won grants. So the pursuit of money is something you can see in the university sector as well as in the private sector. If you're talking about, as you put it, I think the phrase you used was advancing scholarship, I'm not sure that necessarily work in the university sector always does that. Much of it is very narrow indeed, and often writing footnotes on footnotes or engaged in, you know, stupid theoretical discussions which are meaningless other than to those people involved in them, and even often to them. So don't be under any illusions. There are excellent works produced outside the university system, and in fact, an enormous area which is very important, which the universities have done very badly at, which is local and regional history, is generally handled by people who are outside universities. Now, there are some, you know, honourable exceptions to that within the university sector. You know, Leicester had a good department dealing with local history. But, you know, if you take my department, Exeter, where I was until recently professor, I would say that for two decades there's been virtually nothing done on local stuff, which I think is a great pity. So, you know, there is a lot that is important that is done by people who are not members of university departments.
We're drawing towards the close. It's a subject we'll return to because there's a lot to say. But I want to close by contrasting two ideas about history and its meaning. One is that the study of history, it should be relevant to our own times and our own preoccupations. And the second is a quote, which is, we study history to free ourselves from the tyranny of current day opinion. Are these two positions as contradictory as they seem, and where would you stand between them?
You might have to repeat the quote because I'm rather tired, but I think we've got 7.3 billion people in the world at the moment, maybe 7.5 now. So I think there's plenty of people to do and follow all different ways of considering history. I would say that inevitably most people take a present-mindedness because they don't necessarily have the ability or necessarily the interest to consider how it was possible in the past or indeed in the present for people to think differently to themselves. So to that extent, for many people, history is a part and a process. Its meaning is that it validates their present day values. And that's ironically, as I've said, where we're getting with the sort of imposition of modern norms of value or fashionable value in academic life. If you move to the other interpretation, which is it's an attempt to escape from the present, I mean, what I would argue is, done well, the study of the past entails understanding the past in its own terms. That does not necessarily mean you are in some way removed from the present, because some of the things that you see in the past are very reminiscent. People's need and wish to identify themselves, to support themselves, you know, there are very basic elemental forces, culturally, psychological, as well as socioeconomic. But you can only do that if you understand that an age has its own values, multiple values, and its own experiences and contexts, and to treat it all as an expression of the present is obviously deeply flawed and therefore, not surprisingly, very common. Now, that's going to sound priggish and arrogant, but one of the points about working in an area for many decades is you acquire a feel for it and you obviously reflect on others. And, you know, most people are so emollient, you know, they come along with the idea that once somebody's an academic, you should never make critical remarks about them. That's sort of a terrible thing, which is rubbish. I mean, you know, if you mark students up or down, it's reasonable for people to do the same with academics, and including me. But what I am disappointed by, let's just leave it like that. What I am disappointed by is the unwillingness to offer a pattern of humane skepticism that I see as increasingly the case in modern culture. Now, of course, the reality is there are modern cultures, and as I discussed in one of my books, you know, historiography is as much what's going on in Belarus as what's going on in Birmingham. So there are different ways of looking at the past, of owning the past, and of interpreting it to the present. But I am fairly pessimistic about where we are at the present moment. On the other hand, though, you and I are able to have this conversation without some political body shutting us down. And that is, I think, to the good, and it is not the case in many countries of the world.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Contesting History and Clio's Battles, we'll return to this theme, but for now, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to everybody and to all our listeners.
Happy New Year, everyone.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.